The job of the blender is to combine these elements in such a way as to produce an overall flavour.
A wider repertoire of different beverages than ever before.
I think one of the most interesting breweries, and certainly one of the most interesting origin stories for a brewery in Australia.
Single malts, blends, grain whiskies, bourbons and more.
If you want mezcal to be sold around the world, then unfortunately you're going to have to make a compromise.
This is the Drinks Adventures podcast. I'm James Atkinson. And this is the show where I speak to some of the world's most exciting producers of beer, wine and spirits and uncover trends and issues in the drinks industry today. Based in Victoria's King Valley, Pizzini Wines is one of Australia's leading proponents of Italian grape varieties such as Sangiovese, Nebbiolo and Pinot Grigio. As you'll hear today from winemaker Joel Pizzini, it was extremely difficult convincing people to taste what were then exotic varieties back in the 90s and early 2000s. But now, Pizzini has all but phased out traditional Australian varieties like Shiraz from its range. Meanwhile, it has expanded its Sangiovese offering to encompass premium wines at all price points, all the way up to the Rubicori, priced at $140 a bottle and built for long-term cellaring. Pizzini has done this by continually refining its approach to growing and making these wines, taking advice from internationally renowned experts. It's a really exciting project, so first up I asked Joel where it all began.
Well, if we go all the way back, my grandparents migrated from Italy just after the Second World War to find new beginnings in Australia, as there wasn't a lot of opportunity. We had an adventurous great-uncle, Uncle Elf, and he would have been in his very early 20s when he jumped on the ship with a few of his mates from Italy. And that essentially started the migration of the rest of the family. He just kept on writing letters of how good it was here in Australia and to come. And eventually, many family members took that trip. Shortly after they arrived, the tobacco industry was in its beginnings. So then the family joined forces and became one of the biggest producers of tobacco in the Southern Hemisphere as the Pizzini brothers. And that was centred around the township of just south of Bright in northeast Victoria. And then the years passed and tobacco became out of favour. And then we started experimenting with different other crops, vegetables, zucchinis, peas, asparagus. But the distance to market was just too great at that particular time to make it a viable option. But at that time, Brown Brothers had a devastating hailstorm, which wiped a lot of their yields out and their crops. So they then started to approach different Italian families that were growing tobacco to start growing grapes for them. So that was essentially our ticket into the wine industry back in 1978.
And at some point, obviously, you decided to create your own label.
So, yes, as the years passed on, we grew Riesling, Shiraz, Cabernet, all of the traditional varieties. Eventually, in the early 90s, we developed the Pizzini brand. And along that journey, we were also starting to grow Italian varieties. Brown Brothers and Gary Crittenden were really excited about Italian varieties at the time, and so were we, developing our, you know, love affair with those varieties. We embarked on that journey with them. So we started with Nebbiolo, and we planted Nebbiolo in 1987, a few years later than we started planting Sangiovese.
What would have been the consumer take-up of those varieties back then? Was it a hard sell, do you think?
Yeah. I remember working in the cellar door, and we would have our wines strategically placed. We'd have the Sangiovese pitched in between the Shiraz and the Merlot just to try and get them to follow through that order. And I basically said, you're not leaving this place until you've tasted this. So I really had to strongly encourage them to taste it, because they couldn't pronounce it. They were very worried about how they might sound. But once they tasted it, they go, actually, I quite like this. And that's what they left with. They bought the Sangiovese over the Merlot and the Shiraz that they would traditionally buy. So it's been a very strong educational piece for us, just teaching people about the savoury, the earthiness and the style of dishes that it might go well with, that they would enjoy. Yeah, it's been education, education, teaching, teaching for that first 20 years. And now there's so much, you know, people have travelled extensively and they understand different flavours, you know, that are different to traditional Australian varieties, what they would normally taste.
You've phased out some of those more traditional Australian varieties out of your range over those years as well?
Yeah, so we've stopped making Merlot and Chardonnay. You know, we still make Riesling because Riesling is a very good variety for the King Valley, so it's a regional hero, so we really want to keep our regional heroes. We're still making a little bit of Sauv Blanc, but it's just those two bites, and we've only kept Shiraz, but we're phasing Shiraz out of the portfolio. Once we've sold out of our 2019, that's the last of it.
What have you learnt about growing the likes of Nebbiolo and Sangiovese over the years? Have you changed your approach to making those wines significantly?
Yeah, so we've been working with a winemaker called Alberto Antonini for the last 20 years now, and he has really helped train us and changing us about growing grapes for quality wine. He used to be the chief winemaker for Villa Antonori. So he was high up in that corporate winemaking scene. He's based in Sangiovese, and it's one of his favourite varieties. And he has a consultancy business where he travels the globe assisting people to produce Sangiovese. Initially, it was all about managing the vineyards. So fruit exposure, light exposure through the canopy, having nice filtered light through your canopy, not having dense, thick canopies. So keeping everything in balance so you can get maximum maturity. The Italian varieties, especially the reds, have astringency to their tannin structure. It's very important to make sure we get everything ripe. If you get a little bit of greenness in your tannins, it creates very dry, hard tannins. And when you're dealing with Nebbiolo, which is already a high tannin variety, can make it very uncomfortable. And also with your Sangiovese's green, tart edges to what should be nice, fine, chalky tannins. So at that stage, back in the early 2000s, the average alcohol that we were making the wine was about 12.5% alcohol, so it was really quite low. He sort of said we should be aiming for a slightly higher, so 13.5% alcohol, so another percent, just to get a little bit more richness, roundness, and softer chalkiness to the tannins. So once you've got your vineyard methods right and you've got the maturity in the grapes, then it's about extracting everything you can out of the Sangiovese grapes. So we would do lots of skin maceration. So that is once the primary fermentation is finished, which generally takes about 4, 5, 6 days, then we would leave the wine in contact with the skins for at least another 2 weeks after. And what we would also do is we would be keeping that temperature at 30 degrees. So, and what that does, it helps to extract and also soften at the same time. So essentially by the time we'd actually finished that process, the wine was actually quite soft and round and chalky and quite nice to actually drink straight away. And also using lees, so using the sediment after fermentation and after malolactic fermentation, so using the sediment to then stir through the wines. It's quite often used, that technique is used in Chardonnays, as we get that yeasty, bready and really lovely texture that we get from the lee stirring of Chardonnays. And I've really adopted that method across all of my wines. And what it does for reds, it gives it more savoury, earthy and more complexity. When I first started making wines, the Australian industry was besotted by fruitiness and really, really fruit-driven styles of wine. And I just want to make the opposite. We were using hot fermentation temperatures, which is close to 30 degrees, to try to, you know, actively blow off any really fruity characters. Whereas typically in Australia would be 20 degrees, 23 degrees to capture all of that fruit essence. You know, your bolognese's and your meat dishes, the savoury dishes, it really helps to have that those characters in the wine to then go slightly better with food. And it's also managing the acidity, so it's not too high but it's not too low, so it still helps you slightly salivate, so it sort of starts to prepare your body for food.
You've got quite a few different Sangiovese's in your portfolio. Tell me about how you structure those, what the delineation is between the different styles of Sangiovese.
We've been producing Sangiovese since 1996, and Sangiovese is so flexible that makes rosé right through to your top long-aging red wines. So it's amazing and we love that. So it means that we can create a wine from a large range of different soil types that we have. So rosé coming from those light sandy soils, because it's lightly structured, the tannins are light, so it's just absolutely perfect for making beautiful rosé. And then we have a couple of light, juicy, fleshy styles of Sangiovese. So we have a Sangiovese Shiraz and our Nunajazella Sangiovese. They're more based around style and also the quality and the style of wine that is coming from certain vineyards. And then we'll have our Pietrarossa, which is our traditional style of Sangiovese, the first version of Sangiovese that we made. Back in 2013, we introduced another range of the Forza di Ferro as a single vineyard. And then our vine selection is the Rubicori. As we go up the chain, the selection criteria becomes smaller and smaller, so tighter and tighter as to where we actually pinpoint these wines.
At that top echelon, is it a variety of sites that you're drawing from, or is it more around a particular site?
It's actually around a particular site. Yeah. It's one site that's just been continuously, you know, really, really good and just so much better than all of the other vineyards of Sangiovese that we have. My current major project is a soil mapping and soil profiling of our entire vineyard. So finding these awesome spots that we have on our vineyard and creating terroir-based wines. They are really super terroir-based wines. They're from this particular patch of dirt which is within this particular vineyard, and GPSing the area that we select our grapes from. Where that helps us is understanding the variability within the vineyards. Sometimes those little patches ripen quicker or slower. So it gives us the option to go in, we'll pick out this little patch now, and then a week later we're going to go and pick out the rest of the vineyard. So we're really being able to pinpoint and really understand the characters of those particular spots.
I think at $140, that must be Australia's most premium Sangiovese. I can't think of another one that that comes in at that sort of level.
Yeah, and it's a culmination of just lots of hard work, selection, best soil types, and, you know, if you're looking for that style of wine, you'll find the price is the same in Italy, if not double.
And that would be, you know, a Chianti Classico, would it? A high-quality wine from that sort of appellation that would command a really serious price tag?
Yeah, so you're getting your Chianti Reservas and your top-level Chiantis. But also with some of the wineries not using their traditional winemaking laws that gives it that DOCG, they're making them as table wines. So they get... I don't really fully understand it, but they get the lower IGT, but they're quite often premium because they get to make the wine the way that they want to make the wine to give it the best opportunity to be the best wine it can be. It can be hard if you're focusing still just on that DOCG and you believe that that is the pinnacle. There's some faults within that system. So it's really following the wineries and understanding how they're making those particular wines.
Is that something that you think, you know, is a bit of an advantage for Pizzini versus its Italian counterparts with working with these varieties, that you have a little bit more freedom in what you can do?
Yeah, look, we're lucky being winemakers in Australia where we have that flexibility to be, you know, fairly unrestricted. We get audited all the time and they're fairly rigorous audits. So we have a great system in Australia to making sure everyone is working above board, but that, you know, because we have that great flexibility to be able to pick when we want to pick, make the wine the way we want to make it, and to produce the best, you know, the best results we can. So yeah, it's great.
What's been the response from Australians to these real premium Sangiovese's when I think probably a lot of people are accustomed to the variety now, but they're probably more used to it as more of a quaffing style of wine than they would be as a real serious wine that you can put down the cellar for many years.
It's still that learning and teaching people about it. We have them on tasting at their cellar door because I'm a firm believer that even though it might be out of someone's price range, it's that educational piece to say, here, taste this. And I consciously make sure that the wines are very different from each other. So no matter what sort of education base and how much wine they've tasted, I'm hoping that they should be able to tell that there is a difference. They might not be able to tell what the difference is or why and that, but if they can pick up the difference that there is something different about the quality of this particular wine. So it is educating them that the story behind these wines and why there would be that difference that they can taste. Either it's different concentration or different flavour profile or the length that just stays on the palate just so much longer than the Nuna Gisella, which is just a nice quaff of fresh, you just want to keep on drinking it style of wine. Whereas when you're really sitting down and focusing on those higher level Sangiovese's, you can really feel that the length is a lot longer and you taste it and you're still tasting it 15 to 20 seconds a minute after you've tasted.
What about Nebbiolo? Tell me about how your experience has been with growing that variety, because I understand that's a very challenging variety to get your head around. But also there's just a lot of interest in Nebbiolo at the moment, once again from Australian wine enthusiasts getting very excited about some of the old world examples from Barolo and Barbaresco, et cetera.
Yep. Look, we've had a fairly long journey. We'd probably be one of the oldest producers outside Italy, I would say. You know, nearly 30 odd years of experience, and it can be a challenging variety. And where it's challenging is that it needs to be planted in the right site. If it's not planted in the right site, it's really challenging to grow because it can grow very vigorous, can be high yields one year, like super high yields and really poor wine, and super low yields the following year. So it's really challenging having those aspects. It has a long juvenile phase too, so it can have that up and down sort of phase for a longer period of time. And, you know, with regards to making the wine, Cabernet and Shiraz and Merlot on an average year can still make a commercially sound and drinkable wine. Nebbiolo, on the other hand, it's really hard to make a good table wine out of Nebbiolo in those poorer years. So they're the primary challenges. But we sort of learned fairly early on to plant the Nebbiolo in our prime sites and sites where they're up on ridges, well-drained soils, because when we first planted, we had planted in an undulating site. So it was up on the hillside, but it was undulating, so there was gullies and ridges, and we just found that we were always selecting our wine from the ridges and basically throwing out the gullies. They'd get turned to vinegar, essentially.
Not even good enough for rosé or whatever.
Look, yes, they would have been good for rosé, but at that time we didn't have a rosé product. You know, we're only talking about 500 or 600 litres, so it probably wasn't big enough to actually make enough volume to make something out of it. So learning from that experience, we've then developed all of our other Nebbiolo sites up on ridges, well-drained soils, and the management of them is a lot easier.
You're still kind of planting more Nebbiolo and Sangiovese so you can keep growing the volumes of those wines?
Yeah, so Sangiovese at the moment is in huge undersupply in the King. So we're busy planting vines. We've basically been planting a vineyard of Sangiovese every year for the last couple of years to satisfy the demand. And Nebbiolo, we've just sort of finished planting a vineyard a couple of years ago. But I am starting to think that I'm going to need to plant another one very shortly.
Are there any other particular wines you want to talk about before we wrap up? Some other white varieties there, and obviously the Prosecco, a lot of consumer interest in that at the moment.
Yeah, well, Prosecco is one of those varieties. Again, it's in huge undersupply in the King Valley, that is for sure, and we're really making some great styles. The one I'm really particularly excited about is our Attento Pinot Grigio. So it's a new style of Pinot Grigio, really trying to push the boundaries of what people think about Pinot Grigio. So it's selected from a vineyard that's at about 750 metres above sea level, so it's a super cold site, and it's hand-picked and whole bunch pressed, again, very similar to the Prosecco, just to collect the best cuvée. A portion of that goes straight to barrels for a barrel fermentation and slightly wild yeast fermentation as well, and it just helps to build richness and roundness and just gives it just another complexing character. The rest goes into to stainless steel tank for a more of a fresher, crisper blending material. And we use a number of different yeasts with that. We start off a little bit wild, and then once we feel the prickle of the juice starting to ferment, then we'll add a yeast that is really good at reproducing but not very good for fermentation. So we want the yeast there, so then when it finishes fermentation, that we add another yeast in, that strong fermenter, then we do a lot of lees work and lees stirring to really develop the richness and the roundness. And what's in the yeast is polysaccharides and mannoproteins, which help to richness and sweeten up the palate. So we end up with this really brioche character, yeasty, bready, some nutty characters. But the fresh acidity, that's natural acidity from this cold climate with a nice line that runs through the palate. It's akin to those top Chablis in style. It's a really fantastic version of Pinot Grigio.
Yeah, that really sounds like it would challenge, you know, lots of people's perceptions of what Pinot Grigio can be. It does sound more like you're talking about a high-end Chardonnay there.
Yeah, yeah. So, but it's using some of those traditional winemaking techniques. There's just no doubt about it, but it really celebrates.
Are they traditional in Italy, though?
Look, they've certainly been adopted by the Italians. There's a lot more of them aging in, you know, in barriques and in stirring the lees and going to that sort of depths.
Cool. And, you know, how important has it been to the success of these, for want of a better word, alternative varieties that you're working with there, that you've kind of got that movement of other producers also of Italian heritage that are also championing some of these Italian varieties?
Yeah, well, look, it's a lonely affair when you're doing it by yourself. So there's the more and more people that are doing it and celebrating, then it just becomes an easier story for us all to tell. So it's really important that there are you know, lots of people doing it. But the important thing is that they do it well. Because in our early stages of introducing these wines, I'd quite often hear that someone had tasted a Nebbiolo or they tasted an alternative variety and had a poor experience. And then they wouldn't taste the wine. I've worked it out. It's about 7 years later before they've gathered enough confidence to try it again. So that was, quite an eye-opener for me. And especially with Nebbiolo, where we make a style that is a very age-worthy style. And it's not that drinkable as a young wine. So we hold back 3-4 years before we release it because people will have a poor experience if they had the wine straight after it's been bottled, sitting in bottle for 6 months. Or you need a person who tastes the wine and go, I understand exactly where this is going to go. I'm going to hang on to it for another 2 or 3 or 5 years and then I'm going to drink it. But people don't have that level of, visualization of how to predict what a wine's going to be like. So for me, it's about having these moments where someone tastes it and they go, oh, I love this. I'm going to drink it with these people because I know they love it and we're going to eat this with it and I'm going to have it at this occasion. So once you get that, that experience, then, you know, that's what we're really looking for. So that's what's probably the most important thing is making good wines that people have good experience with and doesn't turn them off. And that will go across any new variety that people are trying for that first time.
Well, Joel, it's been a really interesting chat. Congratulations on what you've achieved with some of these varieties and also the beautiful new packaging of the Pizzini wines. Thanks for taking the time to have a chat with us on the Drinks Adventures podcast.
Oh, you're most welcome. Thank you. It was great fun. Thank you.
The Drinks Adventures podcast is produced by me, James Atkinson, with additional production and mixing by Dave Robertson. You can find complete transcripts, links, and other information on the show at drinksadventures.com.au. You can follow me on all social media platforms at By James Atkinson, like my Facebook page, James Atkinson Drinks Adventures, to be kept informed of podcast giveaways and other news about the show. The Drinks Adventures podcast needs your support as listeners. Please do us a favour and leave an honest review and rating for the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. We love hearing your feedback, and it helps inform other people this is a show worth listening to. Or simply drop us a line at hello@drinksadventures.com.au.